Welcome to Radio Taboole, fresh content west of the Middle East, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Levantine Cultural Center. Based in Los Angeles, the center promotes a greater understanding of the Middle East and North Africa with artistic and educational programs that bridge political and religious divides. This week's podcast features a brief Q&A session with Dr. Nadir Attash upon the presentation of his book, Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. It took place at Levantine Cultural Center on November the 6th, 2009.
What I'd like to do tonight is to go over some of the major things that relate to Afghanistan now, because Afghanistan is now the top country in terms of the news coverage in the U.S. With proper information, proper perspective, proper context, then we hope that the right decisions can be made. From the 1950s to 78, this is the period of development, progress in Afghanistan. In the 60s till 1970, we had only 35 high schools in Afghanistan. In about 3-4 years, the number of high schools jumped to more than 200 high schools. The same in terms of middle schools, in terms of what we call village schools, the number increased to 5,000. If you look at the infrastructure in Afghanistan, the roads were built. Some of those infrastructure projects, we got assistance from U.S. For example, the road from Kabul to Kandahar, which is about 300 miles, was built by the direct U.S. assistance. Hydroelectric projects, both by Germans, Russians, and Afghanistan had a functional state, central government that had authority all over Afghanistan. This is a totally misconception that Afghanistan never had a central system. Yes, we had tribal structures, but the tribal structures worked within the government. In fact, it was an extended arm of the government. Of course, once we get into 78 onwards, the situation changes. This area of oppression, destruction, Daud Khan, who was not in favor of democracy, he wanted clean government, but a little bit more authority in power, because in the democracy area, we had so many newspapers that were non-governmental newspapers, and they always criticized the government. We had demonstrations. So a lot of things were disrupted. Millions of Afghans were killed. The conservative estimate is 1.5 million. But then we get to 2002 with the U.S. involvement, and it started with great hopes. Taliban were removed from power. Now we get international promise that Afghanistan is going to be helped. It's a turbulent period for Afghanistan because there are some good things happening, especially in the initial periods from 2001 to 2004. Convening two leaders, I guess, successfully, especially after the internal strifes and the civil war, was a major achievement. Also, the constitution of Afghanistan was drafted. Also, schools were open, close to 6 million children went back to schools. And also the government, with the assistance of the international community, has established clinics in other parts of Afghanistan too. Also, I think the economy grew. And I'm not talking about the illicit economy, the legal, the legitimate economy of Afghanistan. Parallel to this, we have some issues, some problems that is haunting us now. And let me just go over some of the major points. One is, we go back to this ineffectual, weak government. Unfortunately, when the Taliban were being removed, the Americans devised a strategy, how could we do this with minimal effort, with least lives lost, American lives. So we did this war against Taliban through the air mostly, and also with hired guns. Most of these hired guns were the bad characters, the human rights abusers. Unfortunately, it was the easiest strategy to use. Monies were paid to these in conjunction with the U.S. forces. They fought the Taliban. The Taliban were removed from the power. At that time, I think the U.S. could have said, okay, we used you for this purpose. Now you can go and sit down somewhere and we can form a good government. But that was not done. These people were in power and brought into the government. So it's not surprising that the governments became weak, corrupt, and over time it even deteriorated. And now U.S. and international community finds it hard to remove these people from those positions, because over time these people, with the help of the international community, the U.S., those resources, they empower themselves more and more and more, so it becomes harder now to remove them. So that's the one of the reasons that we have this corruption.
And the U.S. would look terrible if the U.S. empowered them and has backed them, and the U.S. and NATO allies, they support the Northern Alliance. So if they take those people out, then they're basically saying we made a mistake.
Yeah, and I'm not. Yeah, exactly. You know? And I'm not talking only about Northern Alliance.
Well,
it's this is a general fact, but we have a lot of those kinds. You know, maybe not one, two, but 100 or 200 of these kind of unsavory characters that the U.S. empowered, and they are still somehow connected to the government or in the power structure, and it's very hard now for the U.S. and the international community to remove them from power. So that's a mistake that the U.S. committed against the Afghan people. The implication is that if the U.S. leaves and leaves these people empowered, then it will take for the Afghans maybe 10 years to fight these people, and another 1 million or 2 million Afghans will be killed to remove these people, because ultimately these people will be gone because the people will not accept them.
By staying there and supporting them, that's just as bad. They're supporting these warlords now.
Exactly. That's exactly what the ordinary Afghans want. Help the people, not these people that are oppressing and abusing the people. Another interesting point is that while the international community has poured in a lot of assistance, for example, the U.S. has spent more than 80 some million dollars. And most of it is military, but yet the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated.
Do you know that this is the most expensive war in the history of the United States, Afghanistan? Do you know that it's $1 million per soldier?
Per year.
Per year.
Yes. This is
the most expensive war ever in U.S. history.
In your opinion, why would the U.S. government be spending that much money? Because you're suggesting that they're not doing it because they really care about democracy in Afghanistan.
In terms of the development strategy for Afghanistan, was designed February 2002 in Tokyo. There was a big conference. They came up with three different options. A major option, they asked that we create this trust fund, and countries should pour their monies into the trust fund, and the trust fund would be managed in conjunction with the donors and the Afghan government. Because of, you know, there was no governance in those days in Afghanistan, they said the UN and some other agencies would monitor that process. And most countries put their money through the trust fund, except the US. US said no. There will be corruption, there will be this, that.
It's because they want all the money to
So the trust fund, the Europeans are putting most of their money to the trust fund.
That's
Japanese are putting this, and mostly the Germans and so forth. But in addition to that, they said, okay, you can do it through your own or through the Afghan government. And the idea was that over time, most of the funds should go through the Afghan government. But that is not the case.
That's not the way USAID is set up.
But some other countries are following that model in the Tokyo, the guidelines. And we are hearing good things about Japan, Germany, some other European countries, their projects, some Scandinavian countries, even though it's not to the scale of billions it's much more effective. Even Indians, their projects are... Even Pakistan, they established them. Iranians have much better development projects. So there are already models and experience in this regard, so that the U.S. can learn. And all they have to do is make the decision that they should do through the trust fund, and then how to monitor that trust fund.
That's right.
It's very easy. So we have ways and mechanisms to benefit from that. But the idea about the trust fund, the part that I didn't like was the UN involvement, because it was 22% right off the bat for management fees, because they were in charge of the monitoring part. And I think that's too much. But I think even with that 22%, it's much better than the U.S.
U.S. internal evaluations show that 85 to 90% of all the funds that are allocated through USAID never leave the country. never get that.
Well, we have the same kind of statistics, similar statistics from a different perspective. Basically, the most of the assessments done in Afghanistan, that the effectiveness of U.S. aid in Afghanistan is about 10%.
It's the model of USAID. We pay taxes. Our taxes go to the federal government. It gets allocated to the State Department. The Congress says how much money of that goes to USAID. Then those programs go to individual countries, and they are bid on through this process, which is called, you know, which is supposed to be an open bid process by these Beltway bandits. And what happens is the money gets filtered right to them. It goes to these corporations like, University Research Corporation or Bechtel or whatever, and the money goes to them, and they send out consultants and things like that. But if they want to buy a chair or a computer to set up an office in Kabul, that all has to be American bought. Everything has to be sent from America. So in other words, pencils. So in other words, this is the way USAID is set up. The consultants must travel on U.S. airlines. They cannot travel on KLM or British Air or any other thing. It is set up, that is the way USAID is designed, so that the money goes straight back to American corporations. So very little actually gets to any country, whether it's at war or not.
If the situation continues like what it has been the past 9 years, there will be a perpetual need for the U.S. troops. And if that's the case, we should stop it now, regardless of what the consequences are, because this the situation is the worst. Now, what we are saying here, that can we find better ways so that we can take the troops out, but yet we can stabilize the situation so that Afghanistan can stand on its own 2 feet.
That can be possible without the troops?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. But for example, we have the Afghan army. And believe me, I have come from a military tradition in my family. And we had between 80 to 100,000 troops. Our military, we spent a good chunk of money on them. We provide them the basic stuff. Of course, during the communist era, our army grew to almost 400,000. I'm not talking about that era, because there we had an extra help from the Soviet Union. I'm talking before that, when Afghanistan stood on its own 2 feet, had enough military to defend. And based on the resources of the country. So therefore, we did not have the most sophisticated tanks. We had tanks. The most sophisticated aircraft, we had aircraft. But right now, when the U.S. goes to Afghanistan, now they have not discussed this with any Afghan. And believe me, when Najibullah was kicked out of power, Afghanistan had a very strong army. So this is the problem. I think we can create an army, Afghan army, within 6 months that can defend the country. And then ask the Americans to leave. But we are not getting, when we have our leadership in the army being suspect of working for some other countries, how could we have an army? An army, you need an ideology for the country. To serve the national interest, national people. So how could you do this? But these are the things that we have to raise these issues. We cannot just remain silent. And I think if you tell President Obama in the administration, now if you're serious about bringing the truth back, if you're serious about the stopping the war, then this is what we should do. Coming back to the current situation, I think President Obama has tried to solicit and secure the help of many people, but a lot of them are not Afghans. In order for a policy or for a strategy to work, you have to know the context. Exactly. I'm here as, I have lived 30 some years, and believe me, if somebody asked me for a policy, I would be at loss. Because all the things, and even though this society is structured, open, everything is written, so you can go and study it, you don't have to live it.
Thank you for listening to Radio Tabule, fresh content west of the Middle East. Please support the programs of Levantine Cultural Center with your contributions. Visit levantinecenter.org to learn more about how you can become involved. Radio Tabule produced by Jordan El-Grabli, Jen Reinhardt, and Frida Becker, with music from Omar Fidel, omarfidel.com.